Time now for hour number two of this weekend's installment, two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Here again is the host, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Stephen Sestanovich. He served as a U.S. ambassador at large to the former Soviet Union during the Clinton administration and as a senior staff member at the National Security Council and the State Department during the Reagan administration. He's going to talk about his new book titled Maximalist, America in the World, From Truman to Obama, published by Vintage.
And you know what I like so much about what you said in the book is I never in the world would have thought of that when you get the presidents who want to go in and fix things and be active in other countries, then you get following them the presidents who do retrenchment, and that is a completely opposite thing, you know, drawing down our resources in other countries and focusing on what we need to do here.
Yeah. I describe maximalism as the policy party. That is, when people are thinking, well, we can do more, we can bring in more resources, really make American involvement the answer to some big international crisis. Retrenchment tends to be the policy hangover.
When I like that word.
Realizes, well, you know, things got a little out of hand there, didn't they? And begin to try to pick up the pieces and scale back a bit. That we've tended to do that after stalemated wars that haven't gone well, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. We also do it a little bit after just big exertions, even if they do go well, so that right after World War II, there was a sense, you know, bring the boys home, we don't have to be so involved. And right after the Cold War, there was the same sense.
It really is fascinating because, you know, when I see the cycle reintroducing itself in a way, and I think unfortunately, but so we have had all these various cycles since World War II, and now you actually, you know, in your book, you put forth what presidents were for expanding our power and what ones really were for reducing it. And another president that I learned a lot about, and certainly I had the common opinions that most people in the public had at the time, and that he was a very, very flexible, conciliatory president, an emphatic president. But you said that he was a real maximalist. So in what way was he really acting in contradiction to what people thought he was?
Wait, which president are you talking about right now?
I am talking about President Reagan.
President Reagan.
Yes.
Yeah, Reagan is a puzzle. A lot of presidents actually are harder to figure out than we sometimes remember them. But I think in Reagan's case, we're kind of remembering him wrong. The general view of Reagan is he was a full-blooded, full-throated, bellicose, cold warrior in his first term, and then he fell in love with Gorbachev in the second term, and then they just had a kind of, you know, friendly ending of the Cold War because they got along so well. Reagan, lots of historians now talk about Reagan's empathy. One of the things that struck me in reading this was that although in reading, doing the research for it, and I also worked in the Reagan administration, was how inflexible Reagan was. He liked Gorbachev. He really did admire him. But he also thought that the way to get Gorbachev moving toward the kind of change in the Cold War and in the Soviet system was to keep the heat on him. So Reagan made very, very few concessions, even though he was the most genial of hosts and really tried to establish a rapport with Gorbachev. But it wasn't a rapport that involved compromise. It was a rapport that involved having Gorbachev come to see it Reagan's way.
Very, very amazing. And do you think that his talents as an actor did help him get his political points across?
It's something that intrigued me a little bit in reading his autobiography. You know, Reagan says that his actor's skill actually did help because, I don't know whether one should take this seriously, but he said that the for actors, empathy is a kind of trick to get other people to see things your way. And there's no doubt that what Reagan wanted was to get Gorbachev to see things his way. I think to a very large extent he succeeded. And he did that partly by being so friendly in the way he described Western democratic ideology, but also, I think, in being extremely firm. And here, another part of Reagan's background, being a labor negotiator as the head of the Screen Actors Guild, probably helped him as well. He was always telling his senior advisors, you know, no, I want to wait for the other guys to make an offer. I'm not interested in making any concessions. So he was a very, he was skilled actor, capable of presenting himself in a particular way to charm the other side, also a pretty hard-boiled bargainer.
Well, I want to talk about our President Obama. Maybe he could use some more acting skills and some of the seeming to have more empathy, because he gives the most wonderful speeches. And so I wanted to talk about the fact that he started out, you know, during his first term, really as a retrencher, because he said at a news conference that long-term nation building, large military footprints were no longer tools of the U.S. policy, because he wanted to have a better financial balance with domestic programs, as some of our other retrenchers presidents have said and done. And now he's using these forcible measures such as drones and special forces strikes. So do you think he is becoming more of a maximalist?
No.
Okay.
Honestly.
And why
I
do you say that?
What President Obama is doing is what retrenchment presidents have typically tried to do, which is, first of all, clean up the mess that they think they were hired to get the country out of. By the way, that's generally popular. We tend to think that retrenchment is a really controversial political maneuver to pull back American power, but generally it's applauded by the American people. Retrenchment presidents are overwhelmingly reelected for a second term. Think of Eisenhower, think of Nixon, think of Obama. But in their second term, they generally discover that there's a demand from within the country and a challenge from outside the country to formulate a policy that deals with new problems they hadn't really thought about terribly much. And that is the time where retrenchment becomes controversial. One of the things I think is fascinating about retrenchment is the kind of debate that it stimulates. Retrenchment is generally the time of our liveliest, most spirited, most creative, most contentious policy debates, where we're really looking at first principles and asking, what is it the United States should be trying to do in the world? I think we're going to have that. We had that debate in the late 50s when people said they weren't quite satisfied with what President Eisenhower was doing. You know, John Kennedy called the Eisenhower administration 8 years of drugged and fitful sleep. We had that kind of lively debate in the 70s and even in the beginning of the 90s after the Cold War, trying to think about what the United States should be trying to do. And I think we're clearly having that debate. Move toward the next presidential election, because both parties are divided about what foreign policy should be.
Yeah, and it's kind of, isn't it also a division between what our foreign policy should be and paying attention to our domestic problems, like our infrastructure falling apart? You know, I see that too.
You know, Hillary Clinton gave an interview a couple of months back in which she made some sort of mild criticisms of President Obama, and people thought she's positioning herself to run as an activist foreign policy candidate. I think she may well have a preference for a greater activism for the United States in international affairs. But she also said, you know, you can't persuade the American people to take a large role internationally unless they feel comfortable about their economic circumstances here at home. So she's very attuned to that, to the balance between the domestic and the international agenda, and I think all of the candidates in 2016 are going to be trying to figure out what that right balance is. That tends to be one important key to retrenchment debates is, do people feel we still need to continue to focus on the home front, or do we need to change the balance a little bit to deal with international crises?
That's Stephen Sestanovich in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled Maximalist, America in the World, From Truman to Obama, published by Vintage. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, which continues in just a moment.
Did you know? An estimated 16 million Americans suffer from a chronic inflammatory facial condition called rosacea, and most of them don't know it. Often mistaken for acne, there are many signs and symptoms of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels. Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, swelling, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. Any one of these signs and symptoms can mean rosacea, and without medical help, it can become increasingly severe and wreak havoc on your personal and professional life. Rosacea typically appears any time after age 30. So if you experience any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist for diagnosis and treatment. Or for more information, visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, here's the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation with Lissa Warren. She's an established poet and works in Boston as Vice President Senior Director of Publicity at DeCapo Press. She's going to talk to Carol about her memoir titled The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat, published by Lions Press.
Your two great passions have always been cats and books, so after your cat, Cinnamon, died and you'd had her for many, many years, you went on a serious search for a new one. So why was it particularly important that the kitten you picked out bond with your family?
Well, we wanted a cat that would be a really good companion for my father. He had had a quadruple bypass and not all of the grafts had taken, and so he had to retire a bit early, and he was able to get around, but his energy was just kind of low, and so he needed a cat that would be fun enough to, you know, keep him engaged and happy and be a good companion to him, but at the same time a cat that could be calm and still and quiet and wasn't a super, super high-energy cat. And so we did a lot of research and found a wonderful breed called a Perat, which is from Thailand, and made calls to breeder after breeder until we found just the right one.
What are the characteristics of the Perat? Are they calm, and why did you want to adopt a female who was the runt of the litter?
Well, we're all small people in my family. My dad was the tallest at 5'4", and we couldn't imagine, you know, a 10 or 15-pound Maine Coon trying to snuggle on our lap. So the Perats are typically maybe 7 to 10 pounds, which seems like a really good size to us. Our Perat is very small. We did want the runt of the litter, and she's only about 7 pounds. And we also are the kind of family that always roots for the underdog. So the idea of having a little run to the litter was nice for us, an under cat instead of an underdog, I suppose. So we knew that the Karat is a smart cat and a loyal cat, and those are qualities that are important in my family. And so she seemed like the perfect choice for us.
And, you know, I saw the pictures of her in the book, and she is so beautiful. She's got gray, short hair, which I imagine is a real plus, and she's got the most beautiful eyes.
Thank you. They're the same green as a lotus leaf. That's what they say in Thailand, where she's originally from.
Now, you chose the name Ting Ping for the kitten, and she certainly wasn't the most well-behaved cat when you got her. What were some of the funny or not-so-funny escapades she got into when she first came into your house?
Well, the very first thing she did is jump in the toilet. We have no idea why. She just, I guess, went exploring and unfortunately decided to start with that. So that was one thing. But there were many, many more. She was fond of redecorating, by which I mean shredding the couch, shredding clothes that my mother would wear, my father would wear. She would run and jump at us and grab on and kind of snag with a claw whatever she was able to snag, you know, sweaters and coats, et cetera, all got ruined because of her. But we were kind of humored by it, I have to be honest and say. There's nothing like a naughty cat, and she was the sweetest thing, but just a little bit naughty, and we loved it.
And let's talk a little bit about that relationship between your dad and Ting. What was it like? Was it as close as you had hoped it would be?
It was, very quickly. Karats tend to bond most closely with one family member, and she chose him, and that is exactly what she wanted, what we wanted. He would go to walk upstairs sometimes, and she would follow him, and my father would turn around to see my mother and I to make sure that we were seeing her follow him, because any good thing, my dad loved to share it, and she was his best thing. She would crawl into the collar of his robe and just kind of sleep there and snuggle, and it was such a comfort for him. It was really exactly what he needed.
And then when your father's health went downhill or disintegrated and he was having angina attacks, was Ting able to provide comfort for him?
Yeah, she would sometimes crawl up on his chest and literally sit right there. It was uncanny. It was almost like she knew that he was having heart trouble. She, you know, was a fun, spunky little cat, but she knew how to temper it based on his mood and his needs, and she could tell when he just needed a napping companion, when that was, you know, what he needed that afternoon or that morning. She was very responsive to him, and they were close as can be.
Now, unfortunately, your dad did eventually pass away. He had a massive coronary.
Yeah.
But Tina really helped you and your mother keep going and fill that void. That was quite remarkable.
Yeah, we, you know, I think anybody who has an animal in their home who they are responsible for and need to take care of, you can't wallow in your own grief for too long. If that animal needs you, you must rally and you must take care of them and give them not just their basic needs, but, you know, the attention, the love that they need in order to really thrive. And so it was very hard, of course. We're such a small family. After my father passed away, you know, I lost a third of my family in one night when he died. But my mother and I focused on Ting and helping her adjust to life without him, because it was a big adjustment for her, too.
And then, unbelievably, Ting developed a life-threatening heart condition less than a year after your dad died. And what extraordinary thing did you do to save her? I mean, it's remarkable.
She was diagnosed with second-degree AV block, which is a situation where the electrical impulses aren't getting from one chamber of the heart to the other like they're supposed to. And our vet told us that if she were going to survive, the only option was to get her a pacemaker, except they don't make pacemakers for cats, and they don't make pacemakers for dogs or any other animals either. However, we found an animal hospital in Boston, Angel Animal Medical Center, that told us they would be able to implant a human pacemaker in Ting. And as I mentioned, she's little. She's only 7 pounds, and the human pacemakers, you know, they're bigger than a silver dollar. I mean, they're pretty substantial in size. But they were confident that they could work the pacemaker in, and lo and behold, they were able to, and they saved her. And now, 5 or 6 years later, she is still thriving. She has not had a fainting spell since getting that pacemaker. It's truly remarkable.
And now, you've been through two difficult crises, your father's death, your cat's life-threatening heart condition, and then, unimaginably, you had your own crisis when you were diagnosed with MS. So how have you dealt with it, and what has made you say there is something you like about MS, and what is it?
Yeah, as crazy as it sounds, when you have MS, you find out very quickly, you know, the difference between the people in your life who care about you and the people in your life who will actually take care of you. There's a huge difference between those two things. And I see now so clearly that I've got great people in my life who will actually take care of me on those days when I need taking care of. I have the good kind of MS. Luckily, it's the relaxing, remitting kind. I have many, many days where I feel almost normal and still really good and really strong. But I have people there to support me on days that I don't. And I have Ting now on days when I'm not feeling well to comfort me. And I understand how much she meant to my father when he was ill, because now when I'm ill sometimes, I've got her right there and she's a comfort to me. So it helps me understand my father and their relationship, and that's kind of a beautiful thing.
Hey, touching story. You've always called Ting your good luck cat, and she's 19 years old, thank goodness. And is she still having good luck?
She really is. She's doing very well. Her 19th birthday was this past Monday. She has a little bit of kidney failure, which is normal for a cat her age, so my mother and I give her subcutaneous injections 2 or 3 times a week. And she has a little bit of asthma, so we give her an inhaler, just like a human would get an inhaler. And she's still happy and, you know, relatively healthy despite all of these ailments that I've just rattled off. She spends her days basking in the sun and is just a very content cat.
...with Carol Marks. Her book is titled The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat, published by Lions Press. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And we are joined at this point for the rest of the way in the program by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now is going to be speaking with Jody Holtzman. She's the Senior Vice President Thought Leadership at AARP. And they're going to be talking about the launch of the Longevity Network to promote innovations in healthcare that will improve, or will allegedly improve, the quality of people's lives as they age. And I guess, without giving away what you talk about, I guess it's possible. It doesn't, you know, it sounds almost it can't possibly be that your life improves as you age, but in many ways it does.
Well, one thing that this Longevity Network is onto, it's a little bit exploitive of people of a certain age. However, it's actually good that somebody is saying, you know what, people over a certain age actually buy things, actually read, actually watch television, listen to music, have taste, and are somebody that you can advertise to, and they will respond.
So it says the quality of people's lives improves as they sell things to old people.
Well, I mean,
that's what you just said.
I sort of just said that, but isn't it, we've talked in this program a lot about how, you know, we're sort of disregarding, oh, you don't buy anything new, you're branded already.
Well, exactly, it's not true. It's not
you. You just do what you've always done. You're not open to new ideas, and that is so false, and this is an organization that's trying to say, hey, you know, we're out here. We're open. We're interested.
Yeah, yeah. And thus, there, you know, from my perspective being involved with this show, and from your perspective being involved with this show, quite clearly if the business community and the advertising agencies in particular were more cognizant of the fact that older Americans are a worthy target for whatever their capitalistic enterprises may be, there would be better media and more programs and more shows and more services in the media for older people. As such, there aren't, and I can't understand for the life of me why not. It doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, Michael, the metaphor might be this whole thing with the New Republic, where this was a magazine that talked about culture, talked about politics, sociology. I mean, it was a very wide-ranging thing. It was almost like the Ed Sullivan Show of magazines on a more serious level, of course. And the idea was never to make money with these things. It was to entertain, to inform, to be a public service. And it's kind of turned out that anything now that doesn't make money is shunted aside, doesn't have page views, as well, it's not worthy because we can't make money on it.
More precisely, and you're absolutely right, we can't make money out of every single molecule of it. But there used to be, you know, let's not think the old days were greater than they were, but in the old days, whatever that means, everything still was designed to make money in our economy, in our country, but there was also an element of pride and quality and service attached to it. So it wasn't that every single aspect of the enterprise was designed to make money. Now, anything that doesn't make money down to the atom is eliminated, and that's the problem. Do you follow my drift?
I do, but where I may slightly disagree is what? That certain areas were not intended to be big profit centers. You know, the priority now is make money, and secondarily, well, if we can entertain and inform and would be good for society, that's okay. And I think the priority used to be, in certain cases, not all, of course, that, okay, let's do something good, and if it makes money, great. If it doesn't, if we break even, that's okay, too. I don't see that much anymore, do you?
No, I don't see that at all. I'm not even sure if they had that in the old days, but, you know, a great example is that the news departments at television networks
exactly.
are separate from the entertainment departments. Now they're all under the same roof. So news today is designed to make money. Now, news has always been designed to make money, but it's designed to make money now on a level that is far more intense. In other words, it's much more entertaining in terms of its intent than it used to be. And that's very troubling because we have to have journalism. We have to have a press. We have to have that aspect of communications in order to have a functional democracy and a society that isn't just stupid. So that concerns me.
Now you're starting to sound like Aaron Sorkin in the newsroom. Are you up to date on that?
I'm up to date on having seen the first two seasons of it. I, off the top of my head, I don't even know if there is a third season. Is there?
The third season is about to conclude this
I haven't
weekend.
Watched it. I haven't watched any of it. Isn't it good?
Well, I mean, this is the whole thing that we're talking about. They're in a situation where they are taken over by a younger fellow who, you know, page views and, you know, really is trying to capitalize and making money on it, who said when he bought the thing that, you know what, I don't need to make money on this. I'm rich already. I just want this to be something good for society. And he turns it around, and all of a sudden this serious news program all of a sudden has gossip pages and celebrity sightings and all kinds of things that really don't matter a whole heck of a lot.
Interesting. I got to check it out. What I'm going to do is I'll binge watch it. It's a good show. Let's talk about this when we pick up after you speak with Jody Holtzman in the final segment of the program, and continue the discussion about does everything get better or can some things get better as you get older. Richard Neer with us, Michael Harrison here. He'll be talking with Jody Holtzman from AARP next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary.
They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here as promised is our senior correspondent Richard Neer in conversation with Jody Holtzman. She's the Senior Vice President Thought Leadership at AARP, and she's going to talk about the launch of the Longevity Network, which is designed to promote innovations in healthcare that will improve the quality of people's lives as they age.
Now, Jody, as you're undoubtedly aware, in this day and age, network can mean television, could mean radio, could mean internet, could mean many things. What is the Longevity Network?
So if I had to pick a single word to describe it, it would be community.
Okay, and that has a wide range of definitions as well. How does one form this community? Certainly, we're not an enclave all living together, right?
Right. So the Longevity Network was pulled together when I and a colleague at United started brainstorming about how together we were really the two largest brands doing things with a focus on people over 50. And my group does a lot of work in what's referred to as the innovation space. So we work with entrepreneurs who are developing companies with products and services that will benefit people over 50, particularly in the health and wellness space. And so we started thinking, well, you know, there's a lot of activity out there, but it's very fragmented. It doesn't have a central nexus that pulls it all together so that all of these disparate parts, the inventors and entrepreneurs, the investors, industry, media, can all see what is going on, but also have a platform on which they can interact and establish those connections. So that was some of the thinking behind the launching of the Longevity Network.
So this sounds kind of like something for business people looking to reach the 50-plus market. Is that the focus, or is it something that the average person who just wants information about health care and longevity and subjects like that can go?
It's really both. My group is a small innovation group, and when we were created, the issue that we confronted was who is out there that contributes to the ultimate success of AARP's mission? And AARP's mission is to enhance the quality of life for all as we age. So, well, you know, government has a role. Nonprofits clearly have a role, but the private sector always also has a role because we buy things that enhance our quality of life. But what we found that was fascinating was that, for the most part, the 50-plus was not front and center for the private sector in any segment, except for those that already had a very specific product that they were selling. But it was not intuitive. It wasn't a very hard sell because the numbers are incredibly compelling. It's over 106 million people. They spend $3.1 trillion every year on consumer spending, another $1.6 trillion in healthcare spending. So the numbers are compelling, but we found that we had to make those numbers clear, transparent, and apparent, to different segments of the business community. Now, that said, the website, longevityeconomy.org, is available to anybody, and anybody wanting to know what are the new interesting innovations in the health and wellness area of relevance to the 50-plus, it'll be a good place to go as well.
Well, you know, this is one of the focuses of our program because we note in the media that people of a certain age are not targeted. They are television stations, radio says, oh, no, they're too old. They're set in their ways. They're not going to buy anything. They're already loyal to certain brands and they won't try things, which is a complete and utter fallacy. And yet it seems that most of advertising people believe that.
Well, I'll give you a good example of that. I am a fan of a show called Longmire, which is about a sheriff up in Wyoming. And
A&E Network.
It's on A&E, I think.
Yes.
And it was just pulled. It had like higher, more people watching it than Mad Men, but they claimed that they couldn't sell advertising. Well, that's absurd. I mean, if you look at CBS, which for years was, kind of referred to as the fuddy-duddy network because they were focused on older viewers, it's also the only profitable network and has the most watched, television shows on TV, starting with NCIS, which, interestingly, if you talk to the head of research for CBS, he will tell you the reason it's the most watched is that it's watched by everybody across the age continuum. The difference between me watching it and my kids watching it is that I watch it on TV and they watch it online.
Yeah, and that's another divergence that we're dealing with. So if the average consumer wants to know this stuff, I mean, is it just centered on healthcare, or are there recreational things? Are there other things that might contribute to quality of life other than just health?
For right now, the Longevity Network is focused on health and wellness, in particular nine different areas of health and wellness where we have been working with entrepreneurs to get them, one, to have products and services that are more relevant, but also giving feedback to them and giving them access to AARP members and people over 50 in general, so that they can get that real-time, consumer feedback.
Give us that website again, Jody.
Yeah, go ahead.
Give us the website again.
LongevityNetwork.org.
That's Jody Holtzman in conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. And if you'd like more information, you can go to the website LongevityNetwork.org. That's LongevityNetwork.org. www.longevitynetwork.org. I'm Michael Harrison. Richard Neer returns for some final conversation as we have the final segment of this two-hour get-together still to go. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You're age 65, and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, and Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we are at the final segment of our two-hour get-together, continuing with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Before your conversation with Jody Holtzman in the last segment, Richard, I was going to ask you the question about the show, The Newsroom. Do they still have that aspect of romance in the third season, goofy romance between the anchor guy, Will, and the executive producer, whatever her name was, the English woman, and then
McKenzie.
Other...
McKenzie,
right. I always got confused. McKenzie and McAvoy. And then there were the other subplots with romances. Everybody was in love with everybody, and everybody was getting messed up about it. Is that still... Is that one of the... Is there always that story arc going on again in the third season? Just curious.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Murder,
I mean, the inter-office romances are there. And, you know, you and I have worked in big media organizations, and, you know, maybe they were there then. I just didn't know.
It just
know
ruined
a lot
the show.
About
it ruined
them.
The show to me. To me, that was, you know, Sorkin pandering to, again, you know, if you want to do a show about. If you want to do a show about issues of journalism and issues of politics and issues of corporate structure and all that, fine. I could live without the tawdry romance. That just seems to me like they put it in because HBO said, hey, Andrew, it can't all be news. It's got to be some, you know. It just seemed that they're pandering to lowest common denominator tastes to make the show more interesting.
Well, I could see that, too, but I think it also humanizes the characters. You know, it also makes them real aside from what they do on television. You know, that they have lives, that they have romances, that they have failings, that they have personality quirks. So I think that was probably what they were trying to do with it. My biggest objection to that show is the rapid dialogue where, you know, some of the lines are very good, but you don't really have time to digest them before somebody else is saying.
Well, the dialogue sounds like each person talks off the cuff as if they were writing a polished editorial piece for, Wall Street Journal or something. Give me a break. But whatever. Yeah. Hey, it's entertainment. We expect too much of it, and it's still a pretty smart and pretty good show, and I'm going to check it out this season. I missed the whole damn season. Wow. So listen, here's what I want to talk about in the last couple of minutes. Do you feel like you're a better person? Are you happier at this age than you were, say, at 40 or 20 or at 10? Is being now in your 60s and moving on, are there benefits to it, in your opinion?
There are, in a lot of ways, because there are certain things that aren't troubling you that troubled you perhaps in your youth. But I think, I don't know if I could say I'm happier. I can't, you know, can you gauge how happy you were in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s versus today? I really can't.
I understand happiness more now than I did then. And I find that I don't need as much to not be unhappy. Let's just say that I'm less apt to be unhappy over frivolity than I might have been when I was younger. I think it's called wisdom. In other words, you have your priorities set. I also find at this age, you don't have to worry that much about, you know, what am I going to do in 30 years, 40 years? You probably won't be around. And that gives you a certain peace of mind. It does.
Well, it does. I'm thinking 30 years ahead and thinking, well, if I'm not around, where am I going to be? I mean, that's something that I think preoccupies a lot of our thought. Like, okay.
Next week we'll talk about reincarnation. And
you know, I'll go to sleep and I won't wake up. And then what happens? Where am I?
That's a horrible ending to a two-hour show. But
well, it's a good ending.
The clock
is an ending.
Everything ends. All right. Thank you, Richard. Okay, at least we're laughing. Thank you, Beverly Santinello, our producer. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, certainly, to Gun Hill Road for joining us on this episode. And thank you, all of our affiliates and listeners across the country. I'm Michael Harrison. On behalf of Carol Marks, the host of our program, we invite you to join us next weekend right here for another two-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.